Accession number 27755, Reel 4.
Leslie Wright, Reel 4. You were saying the Malta was in a pretty worse for wear.
Yeah, it was. Right. Oh, very worse for wear. When I went up, I made one trip into Valletta once, so walked down to there, and as I walked down the roads coming into Valletta, either side was mounds of debris and just the skeletons of buildings behind it showing, you know, it was out, battered to pieces. There were more bombs dropped on Malta than on London. More bombs on Malta than there were on London overall. And that island is only about 16 miles long and 6 miles wide.
Just about everything would be hit then.
All the destruction was terrible. Mostly in and around the capital of Malta, you know, because that's where Grand Harbour was. And any shipping that managed to get there, they were on it immediately, destroying it. Before we could get any supplies off of it. That was the idea, you know. So it was.
How about the Maltese people? Were they just going about their daily?
Oh, yes. They were wonderful people. And they were easy to get on with because they were virtually British, weren't they? They all speak English, you know. And they were absolutely pro-British, all of them. Yeah. Yep.
What did you do when you weren't working as Air Sea Rescue? You obviously would have a lot of time waiting for a call.
Yeah, you just wait. Uh-huh. Yeah. Wait up in the crew room there, you know. We used to knock about probably some of the chaps had handguns. We used to practice shooting their targets around the crew room up, you know. Yeah, it was... There were long periods of waiting, yes, between these things, you know, but we all seemed to be either in the hut playing cards or whatever, you know, all ready to go as soon as any emergency arose, you know. We were right there on the spot, the aircraft were always all ready, you know. All we had to do was dash out to the aircraft and go.
Generally the swordfish that you favoured for doing the AFC rescue?
The swordfish I flew in more than the other aircraft, I think. Although I'm not sure, it might have been about the same. I flew several times in Beaufort, I know. But with respect to our work, we had the ferrying work to do. If that came up, we'd have to go and do the ferry work, you know.
On your Blenheims?
In the Blenheims, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
These VIPs you're ferrying, can you recall any of them? Were any of them senior posts in the
army? They weren't a lot. I can't remember. I think I'll put the name of one down in here. I'm not sure.
There was no VIPs, isn't.
They were just senior officers, you know, officers of senior rank and so on and so forth, that had business either on the mainland or on Malta or whatever, you know, whichever. We just used to shunt them over to El Adam, is where we dropped them, and then they'd get transport from there, either further flying or road transport from there, wherever they were going, you know. All our job was to get them from Malta to the mainland or from the mainland to Malta.
Did you ever conduct any Air Sea Rescue operations at night time?
No.
No?
No, I don't recall any at night, no. I don't think there wouldn't have been any point. We couldn't possibly have spotted them at night.
Not visually, anyway.
We didn't have any lights of any description on board. No, it was only a daytime operation. And in any case, all of these raids, as I told you, 10, 12, were a day. I don't recall any night raids at all whilst I was there.
But there was plenty of raids that took place while you were on.
Oh,
Malta.
Yeah. Yes.
What do you remember about the raids?
Yeah. Yeah, and I was in a hospital up there on Sleema for 5 weeks when I contracted bacillary dysentery. And I was up there, and we used to listen to the Stukas coming down over the top of us, and we thought we were the target most of the time. Whilst we were laying, I was on a bedpan for a fortnight. Couldn't move from the bedpan because of this dysentery business. So we were completely immobilised, and we used to have to lay there and listen to this screaming of the Stukas. They used to scream when they came down, you know. They deliberately made the noise to intimidate the people on the ground, you know, apart from the bombing. But they came in over that drone, and the thing was, that was the 45th General Hospital. It was run by the army, but they dealt with all service invalids, you know. But on the northern side of it, there was a massive concrete circle about 20 foot in diameter, painted white with a big red cross on it. And knowing the Germans' tendencies, we thought we were going to be the target, you know, because that would have been like a bait to the Germans, that sort of thing.
You say knowing the German tendencies, you need to bomb Red Cross.
Oh yeah, they'll bomb anything. Yeah, especially if they knew there were servicemen there. You see, eliminate the servicemen. That was the way they worked. So,
what was the procedure usually when a raid came in, and what would your procedure be? When a raid was
coming. Find the nearest shelter. Actually, when I was when we were on the drone, we had to do nothing. When I was there, although Half Far was targeted many times prior to our being there, there was never a raid on Half Far when I was there. So. We were quite safe there, that distance away from the harbour. That was their target, that harbour, because that was all the main buildings of the island are all around that area. Look.
What harbour are you pointing to?
Valletta.
Valletta. Right.
Yeah, Grand Harbour. Look.
And that was the main.
That is the main berthing place for all shipping that came in there. That's where the tanker Ohio finally limped into there, almost sinking, and it was the first ship to break the blockade. And they had a go at that before we to try and destroy it, before we could get the oil off of it, the fuel that was so urgently needed on the island at that time, you know.
Were you there at that time?
Oh yeah.
What do you remember about the ship coming in?
I didn't see the ship come in at all. We spent our time there or in Berzebuja, which was where we were billeted. Look, that's where I was billeted. So I was three or four miles away from that sort of activity that took place, you know. And I never felt it necessary to go into Valletta, except that one time that I wandered down there. And before I'd got into the town, I was stopped by a military policeman and charged with being improperly dressed. So I buggered off back to Berzebuja. I thought, damn it, I won't bother.
What were you wearing?
I was wearing khaki bush jacket and shorts, khaki socks, my black pumps, and a blue battle dress top. And the Glengarry, of course. And that was what we flew in. That's all we needed to fly in there. We didn't need any aerial at all, you know.
You were there when the invasion of Sicily took place on July the 9th, 1943.
July 9th, yes. Yes, we were, yes, that's right. Yeah, we... apart from a few minor hiccups, that invasion went like wildfire, you know. And Malta, from being such a hive of activity, became absolutely dead as a dodo. We had absolutely nothing to do at all, not even ferry work. There wasn't any ferry work to do. So we applied for a posting to a more operational theatre, and it came through in August 43, and we were sent to LG224 in North Africa to pick up the Mark V Blenheim, the Bisley, and fly it to Burma to join the Bisley squadrons. We got to Moripur, which is Karachi, after 5 days, five legs, you know, of days, and not flying all the time, you know, just say leg or something, and then stay overnight. We did it in five stints, and we reported into Moripur, and the flight officer asked my pilot what we were doing there, and he said, we're on the way to Burma to join the Bisley squadrons. He said, no, you're not. He said, they've been taken off operations yesterday, you know, the day before we arrived there. He said, you're now ferry to 21 ferry control, which was what was based at Moripur. And that was to ferry aircraft to all the various places that they were needed in the Far Eastern theatre. So we did, the first ferry trip we did was to take the Bisley that we had flown out there to Allahabad, because it was being presented to the Raja of Allahabad to join his little air force. So that was the first trip, and that was the only ferry trip that my pilot and I did, because a week after that we were separated from our navigator and sent up to Peshawar to convert onto the Volta Vengeance, which was an American dive bomber still in use by the RAF in Burma. So we thought, well, at least we will get to go there, you know. And we did this course. We did 2 months of this course, 152, I think it was. 152 OTU, operational training unit.
Where was this based?
At Peshawar, just near the Khyber Pass. And we did a fortnight there. My pilot did a normal pilot conversion from one type to another. I had to convert to a radio navigator because my job was navigating the aircraft from there on in, as well as being the gunner, you know. Anyway, we completed this course satisfactorily.
What did you do in the course, if you could explain what you're...
We did several cross countries with me carrying out the navigation in order to show that I had learnt how to get the aircraft from A to B, B to C, so on. The pilot, as I say, is just a normal conversion from one type to another. All he would have been told is probably the different types of things that happened there. One of the most important things that was not on any other aircraft was the wobble pump. Now, this was a hand-operated pump that could be used to pump fuel to the engine in case you lost the mechanical means of pumping to it. And what happened when it occurred, the pilot would start pumping, and his pump handle was linked to one in the rear cockpit. And when the crew member saw the wobble pump going, he had to take up pumping to leave the pilot free, two-handed, for any other operations that might be necessary to the situation, you know. And that was the only difference that I expect that this would have, not my pilot would have noticed in that respect. Otherwise the flying was just simply getting used to the type of aircraft.
What was the Volta Vengeance like? Can you describe?
Yeah, the Volta Vengeance is a single engine aircraft that weighs 5 tons. Most of the weight was in the nose because it was a right cyclone engine, so that it flew straight and level in a slightly tail down attitude. So forward vision was very limited on it. When it was on the ground, you couldn't see forward at all, actually. It was only when the tail came up you were able to see forward, you know. But it was efficient as a dive bomber. It was was equipped with dive brakes, which you had to use before going into a dive, because if you exceeded 340 knots in the dive, when you pulled out, there was a chance that you'd, your wings would break off if you exceeded that speed, you know. So we practice all that sort of thing on the Baltic engines, and it worked all right. You know, when the brakes went out, it was like running into a brick wall. But then you just rolled over on your back and just dropped your nose and went straight down. You went actually straight down. You could just sit in your seat like that and look straight at the target, you know.
What was your position in the plane? Did you have your back to the pilot, or were you sitting on the wrong side?
No, in that case I had a seat that swiveled, because I had to sit forward to be able to put my charts out on there and navigate, you know. Then in the case of enemy action, I would slide the seat back and swivel round and handle the 2.5 Brownings they were in the Voltive engines, and handle their guns for protection of the aircraft, you know. Plus the pilot had forward firing guns on that, so he would be firing all the time he was diving down towards the target, release the bombs as he pulled out, and then I could have a crack at it, you know, when we were pulling away.
0.5 is quite a different gun.
0.5s were big guns there. Yeah, they were big guns. But that was what they were for. So, as I told you, when we got back to Maripor, we expected to be posted a bar, instead of which we were sent across the other side of Karachi, 5 miles the other side of Karachi, to Drigg Road, and attached to the Indian Air Force Unit 22 Anti-Aircraft Cooperation Unit, and we had to tow drogues and gun them for the Indian Army and Navy. Now, why the hell we did a 2 month course, I will never know. We could have done that job with our eyes shut, without any training whatsoever. All I had to do was learn how to turn a propeller type thing into wind in order to wind back in. The drogues just ran out. Once you release the drogue, it ran out automatically, you know, and we used to run it out to 1,000 yards, I think it was, behind it. But in order to wind it in, this prop thing, which was feathered horizontally, you know, had to be turned into wind to start rotating, and it wound the drogue all the way back in to just below the aircraft. And then when we got back to the base, we flew over a set area, and I had to cut a cord connection between the drogue and the line. I had to cut that to drop the drogue on, because you couldn't land with it on, you know.
What were the drogues made of?
Well, they were sort of much like the windsock that you see on all air drones, you know. That's all it was. And we had 4 of those in the Vengeance in canisters on the side, and they could be released from there. But I think we had one shot off by the Navy once, but other than that, usually one drogue was enough. But the gun laying exercises were done without the drogue. We flew at 10,000 feet up and down a set course, and the guns, the anti-aircraft guns, were aimed directly at us, but the shells were fused at 16,000 to go off at 6,000 feet rather, which was 4,000 below us. But we came nearer to being shot down on those runs than we did anywhere else in my service career, because some idiot fused it at 10,000 feet, and quite often we had a black plume of smoke to the beam or just the stern of us, you know. Yeah, it was quite, it really was ridiculous.
This was the Indian Navy, did you say, that was firing at you?
We flew for the shore batteries at Karachi. There was a naval shore battery at Karachi, and we did drogue tow for them, and we also did one simulated torpedo attack in formation of 3. And that was... And that particular instance was my 4th prank, the the only one which I was injured in, actually. Pranked five times altogether in my service career. First in the Blenheim, as I told you, then the Swordfish, we crash landed. The next one was a Volte Vengeance from this and Heracraft from. We got up to 5,000 feet one day, and the pilot I flew with any pilots in on that thing, not always with my own pilot. And this was one of the new pilots, just arrived, a flight sergeant. And he was cussing the thing up and hill and down dale all the way. What a sluggish cow this is, and you know. Got to 5,000 feet and boof, the engine stopped. That was it. So we had to crash land on an emergency strip at the north side of Karachi Airport. We got down there all right, but we got down all right without suffering. But
That was your third prime.
Yeah, belly landing. We had to make a belly landing look in that one. Lost the prop, but it didn't do a lot of damage to the aircraft. But apparently, our ground crew officer, who I knew quite well, he knew me quite well, you know. I don't remember his name. I don't ask about names. I can remember faces, but names, I just cannot, you know. Anyway. He came up to me after when we got back to the drum. He said, what happened, Les? I said, I don't know. I said, I can't tell you. I said, all I know is that he was cussing the thing uphill and down there. And I said, it did take quite a time to get off the ground and to climb up to 5,000 feet. But other than that, I can't tell you. He said, well, we just propped the thing up, put a new prop on, and started the engine, and there was nothing wrong with it. So it was fairly certain that there are two mags in these engines. You have to test both of them for rev drop before takeoff. And there's a certain figure given you as the maximum permissible. If it drops more than that, then the thing's not to be taken off, you know. But my opinion is that he either forgot to put one of them back on, or he knocked one of them off inadvertently after he'd taken off. But it was sluggish on takeoff, so it's probable that he didn't put one back on, you know, and was trying to fly with one mag working, which is only barely half the power necessary being used, you know. But that was that one.
That was your third prop.
No, that was number three. That was number three. That's
yeah.
Right. Yeah.
And number four was a torpedo. Did you say
your? Yeah, that was the torpedo one. We'd just done 2.5 hours of simulated torpedo approaches, flying back and flying out over the desert at 0 feet, and I mean 0 feet. You know, you could practically pick the grass as you went by. You know. Anyway. We were number three in the formation, and we came back in after the exercise and climbed up to 1,000 feet, which was the circuit level. Number one was down, number two was on finals, and we were on upwind leg, still at 1,000 feet, ready to go around for our shot. And all of a sudden I saw the wobble pump going, so I picked it up and whammed away, you know. But it didn't make any difference. The engine didn't start again. But my pilot made a vicious 180-degree turn, intending to get downwind on the runway in use, you know. He overturned slightly, fortunately, because number two didn't see the red flare, to tell him to go round again, and came on in. And we passed him on the runway, we on the crash strip now, to the side of the runway. Had we got on the runway, I wouldn't be talking to you now, of course. But anyway, we were off the runway, and we were running up towards the assembler line, where there was hundreds of ground crew at work on the aircraft there, you know. And the pilot I was with that day, he knew we wouldn't stop in time, we were running too fast. So he just banged on the anchors and we flipped over onto our back and slid the last 15 yards or so on our back, you know. And that was, as I say, that's the only one I was injured in. I recall suddenly seeing the ground, and it seemed to go up over there. Of course, we were going over that way. And I watched it all the way around, so that when we hit, I was looking at the top of the canopy, and I only had the seat belt type safety belt. So I shot through that and hit the canopy, you know. And I was lacerated down my arms, all minor injuries, which obviously put my arm up to wield. And I got a cut there and a cut there.
Cut in your mouth and a cut in the wheel, right?
Yeah. And this was what happened. We initially, there was this terrible grinding and scraping of metal as we slid along the ground, you know. And then all of a sudden, there was absolute complete silence, and I mean complete silence. I couldn't hear a single thing. And then I saw what I thought was smoke coming up, and I thought, it's time to get out, Leslie. So I hit the safety strap, my safety strap release, and dropped a foot on my head. And my pilot did exactly the same thing in the front cockpit. But then I was left with an area about that size, I would think, no more.
30 inches.
Yeah. I had to get out, and I had a seat-type pack on in the vent. It's the vent, so I used a seat-type pack, not the normal one that crew members wear. That is just the harness, and the pack is kept separate. You have to walk that on when you need to use it. And I started to crawl out the right-hand side. Suddenly a voice came from there, "This way, mate, this way, mate." So I crawled back through and went out the other side. It was one of the ground crews rushed over, you know. Quite a lot of them rushed over, but this one got there. I stood up, and this ground crew bloke, he went as white as a sheet. He said, "Bloody hell." I thought, what's the matter with him, you know? I looked down, and I bled like a stuck pig. It was only an inch or so, inch and a half cuts here. The whole right-hand side of my bush jacket, shorts and sock was soaked in blood. And that's what he... He said, "The ambulance is over here, mate." I said, "Hang on a minute." I said, "Let's get this chute off." Oh, right. He took the lock to a release, you know, and he banged it so damned hard he nearly winded me. But it came off anyway. And my own pilot turned up just then, and I said, "That's your pick up your chutes, this." I said, "That's your chute there, you know." And then we were off in the ambulance and off up to the sick bay, the two of us, where we stayed 48 hours. They keep you there for 48 hours in case of delayed concussion, you know. But we were back at work directly after that.
What does it say in your logbook for that event?
Oh. 28-8-844, Vengeance AN-931. Pilot that day was one Officer Bailey, not my own pilot. We did a shoot up for the RIN and had sustained emergency landing in which slight injuries were sustained by both the pilot and myself.
Was the pilot okay, or was he?
Yeah, he cut all across his forehead because it his screen and... there was an inch and a quarter thick bulletproof glass all collapsed in, and he had all minor lacerations across his forehead and that, plus a big bump on his head like I had, you know.
Who was your normal pilot? Was that the same one that you trained with in England?
It was Thistlethwaite. Arnold Baird's Thistlethwaite.
You have a good relationship with him?
Oh, yes. We're like brothers. Yeah.
Just saying you had a good relationship with your...
Yes, we were like brothers. That I lost contact with him after the war. I was in contact with him for some time, and then suddenly lost contact because he moved, and I think I moved somewhere about then. So we lost contact. But when I retired, I set about searching for him, and some of the pilots that I flew with later on in my tour was test and dispatch flight, and that was one of the letters I got back. I finally contacted him, and I was able to keep in touch with him on my daughter's computer, you know.
He mentions a story. I often tell the story about the time we went on a night flying exercise up in the north of England. They got caught in the blue barrages with bleeps going off right, left, and centre.
Yeah.
What happened to that flight?
That was the one where we pranked, yeah.
All right.
Yeah, that was where we got caught in the searchlights, like I told you, on that final trip at OTU.
What's it like when you get caught in searchlights?
Oh, it's the whole place is incandescent, you know. They're incredibly strong, those searchlights. And you can't get out of them, you know. It's a job to get out of them. Once they catch you, they seem to be able to hang on to you like nobody's business, you know. But we were lucky that they obviously didn't think there were any threat to them, you know. But yeah, that was one of the. I'm afraid he died last June. He suffered a brain tumour.